From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made when the U.S. Supreme Court released its decision on a case called Flowers versus Mississippi. The case involved the prosecution of a black man named Curtis Flowers, prosecuted for the same crime six different times. A murder case, and prosecutor Doug Evans repeatedly used his discretion to have black men and women excluded from the jury pool. In this country, you cannot exclude someone for being on a jury just because of their race. That goes back to a 1980s decision. We'll get to that in a moment. But for now, let's keep our attention on Flowers v. Mississippi. Prosecutor Evans tried to use what are called peremptory strikes to remove black jurors. Then he would argue the case, confident that a mostly white or all-white jury would convict Flowers. In fact, out of 42 possible black jurors over those trials, Evans successfully struck 41 from the jury pool. Finally, after a sixth try, he won the case and the sentence was upheld by the Mississippi Supreme Court, and so Flowers took it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court decided 7-2 that the prosecutor had flagrantly broken the rules. Flowers essentially won, and Judge Brett Kavanaugh wrote the opinion, the majority opinion, saying that the prosecutor's history of striking black jurors was a factor and made for an obvious case of discrimination. But Justice Clarence Thomas wrote the dissent, and for the first time in 3 years, Justice Thomas asked questions during the proceedings. He was clearly fired up about not only this case, but what is called the Batson Rule. That stems from the 1980s case. In the past, attorneys were given a set number of peremptory strikes. They could remove people from the jury pool without giving a reason why. Some states would allow 8 strikes, some 6, some more, some less. But in the 1980s, the court decided that attorneys can't just exclude a juror based on race. This was supposed to settle the matter. It didn't. Almost immediately, prosecutors started to train each other in techniques to get around the Batson Rule. They would ask a series of questions to black jurors, and they would tell the judge that no, their desire to strike the juror is not based on race, it's based on some other factor. That's exactly what happened in the Flowers case. Prosecutor Evans asked possible black jurors an average of 29 questions. He asked possible white jurors an average of 1 question. Still, Justice Thomas says this was a poor decision, and he says Batson is essentially bad law. Thomas accused the majority of taking Flowers' case, making this decision, because it wanted to, quote, scorn Mississippi state courts, or perhaps, quote, because the case has received a fair amount of media attention. And the media, Justice Thomas warned, often prefers to titillate rather than to educate and inform. Thomas dismissed Kavanaugh's opinion as manifestly incorrect, insisting that Evans had perfectly good reasons to strike 5 black prospective jurors from the final trial, but his colleagues said otherwise. Well, here's why this matters. Justice Thomas's comments indicate that the Batson Rule could come under threat in the future, particularly depending on the composition of the Supreme Court going forward. And this hour, we discuss how juries are constructed and whether the effort to stop racial discrimination is working. Let's welcome our guests for the hour. With us in studio, our guests include principal attorney with the Foti Law Firm. That's Mark Foti. Mark, welcome back to the program. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Also with us is Aaron Frazier, an attorney with Harris Beach. Aaron, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
And a couple of partners with ETKS. That's Easton, Thompson, Kasparik, and Schifrin. Bill Easton, welcome back to you, Bill.
Great to be back, Evan.
And Don Thompson. Welcome, Don. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
First of all, that's a lot of history I tried to kind of digest in the introduction, and I'm doing my best here because I first encountered the Batson Rule in a podcast in 2016 that I would highly recommend to listeners, and I'm cribbing a little bit off the work there from our colleagues at WNYC. The podcast is called More Perfect, and the episode was called Object Anyway, and it's about the Batson Rule, but it's also about whether it has worked. And so I want to start by asking for some opening comments from our guests here who have in various places not only encountered this rule but thought about the makeup of juries, what's fair and what's not. And I'll go around the table and ask for some general thoughts either on the Flowers case or the Batson Rule. Then, listeners, you're going to hear some sound that will probably shock you, but we're going to digest a lot this hour. Aaron Frazier, what do you make of the Batson Rule itself? Is it working?
I don't think so. I think it has a noble ideal, but there's a very definite and clear practical matter that I think prevents it as being as effective as it possibly can. And it's especially acute in a smaller legal market like Rochester, where in order for a judge to essentially grant about a Batson challenge, the judge essentially has to suggest or insinuate that the prosecutor is doing something with the appearance of racism in mind. And that's very hard to do when the judges and the attorneys in a smaller legal market, they know each other. So that's a practical matter that prevents these challenges from being successful a lot of the time. And in many instances, they're not successful because in order for the prosecutor to successfully rebut a Batson challenge, they just have to offer what's called a race-neutral reason. And
give me an example of a race-neutral reason.
I got a bad gut feeling from this juror. He was scowling at me. And some judges will buy that. You know, and this juror didn't seem like he wants to be here. You know, he's not attentive. Things like that. Some prosecutors will make that argument, and some judges will buy that sort of thing. And it just could be a pretext, and then you have to go through another round of argument between the judges and the attorneys for the judge to try to figure out, you know, is it a pretextual argument that the prosecutor is making to defend his challenge or objection to the juror, or is it, you know, a real thing? And judges have a lot of discretion on that, and then if you want to appeal it, the judges get deference from the appellate courts on the decisions that they make. So it's a very hard decision, a very hard challenge to make, and even if you feel that the trial judge got it wrong, it's even harder to get it reversed on appeal. So you have that legal technical hurdle that you're facing. But the practical one, in my experience, is much greater, because judges don't want to say that an attorney who regularly practices before them is doing something racist.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I hadn't even thought about just sort of the relationship aspect of it. Even with all the work that I did to kind of try to understand this issue before this program, just that practical matter.
Right.
I hadn't thought about it, which may indicate why, at least in 2016, when WNYC examined this issue, there were some states where there hadn't been a Batson challenge upheld. I mean, out of dozens. And we're talking, I think, in Tennessee, there was one out of 48. I mean, if most of the time, Aaron's correct. When a prosecutor would say, oh, no, judge, we don't want to strike this juror because this juror is black, it's because they grew up in the same town as there's just, you know, I mean, I just got a feeling if they grew up from the same town, they might be biased. Has nothing to do with race. As long as you come up with some reason, most of the time, judge will go, okay.
Exactly.
Okay. Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, I think Aaron's point, I agree with it wholeheartedly. I believe that Batson's been a failure. Yes, it's deeply rooted in ideals. The principles are wonderful, and the goal in Batson is that there's an equal protection right that a defendant has to be tried by a jury of his or her peers, and that includes juries that reflect the community. And I think we have in New York, just as much as in Mississippi, we've not lived up to that. We do not have jurors that reflect the community. And a defense attorney and her client is entitled to that. Batson is an attempt to address that, but it doesn't address it practically. It does not appreciably increase the level of minority representation on jurors. And it's critical. Because that type of perception is what drives a case. You can read the Flowers case. You could see that there's six trials. It's like a mini experiment with controls in it, and the ones that were like there were a couple all white jurors, jury panels, and one were 11-1, and there were a few in the middle just because of like chance that the African American component of the jurors was higher, and those were all hung jurors.
Yeah, something like the fourth and the fifth trials were hung juries.
Yes, and those are the ones with the highest, with an appreciable amount of minority representation. I mean, the underlying demographics in Flowers is that it was a community with 55% African-American population and I think 45% white. The jurors were pretty much 12-0, 11-1, and I think 9-3 in the middle. And you wonder about that. It's like, you know, the system's not working to start with. Is that the juror panel should have a greater percentage, and it should reflect the composition of the community. Without that, we're getting trials that are not doling out justice, and just as importantly, are not perceived as doling out justice.
Mark Foti, it was Thurgood Marshall who said after Batson in 1985, I think, his remark was, this is a historic decision, and it will fail. He wanted peremptory strikes removed entirely, which we will get to. And I suspect that's where we may see some disagreement on the panel. But what do you make of Batson? Is it working?
So just to clarify that, there's two types of strikes typically available to attorneys who are engaged in the voir dire process of jury selection. And there's for cause challenges, which is essentially a legal challenge to a juror's qualifications. And it's based on an argument that the questioning of the juror has elicited information to support that that person is not qualified to sit as a jury, that they won't be fair or impartial. And separately, to ensure that each side is capable of eliminating jurors who haven't overtly indicated their information that disqualifies them, but there's other information of concern based on trial strategy or the specific facts of this case, you're provided with these peremptory strikes. So the peremptory challenge is one that's generally in the attorney's discretion. And Batson here is an effort to say that discretion doesn't go to include things like discriminatory intent. You can't strike somebody merely because of their race, and it's been extended over time to include other things such as gender. So in its application, has it failed? I can think of one or two cases off the top of my head where a successful application has been made, where ultimately a juror was seated as a result of a Batson challenge to a prosecutor's effort to strike that juror. But that's extraordinarily rare. It just doesn't happen very often. And that gives great concern over the actual application of the rule that was set forth in Batson. And Aaron makes a good point, which I would agree with, that when you're in the court, it comes across when you make the Batson challenge as something that's perceived as offensive to the prosecution. You're essentially calling them racist, even if that's not the intent. It won't stop a good defense attorney from making that challenge, but the prosecutor will sort of act or give the perception that they're offended, and then the court's in a position where they have to essentially affirm that the defense attorney has made a valid argument, or they're going to back off of it. And if they back off of it, you lose that juror and their ability to have some input on the process. And that's particularly problematic, especially because, and this is the other thing, is it's somewhat known that certain DA's offices over time have, or maybe not DA's offices as a whole, but certain prosecutors who want to circumvent Batson have developed strategies to do so. And in terms of setting forth a reason, it doesn't need to be a reason so strong that the prospective juror could be eliminated based on a for-cause challenge. It really has to be any race-neutral reason. And growing up in the same community was one that you mentioned, Evan. That's one that's commonly used. Also, whether they're familiar with the area of the crime. If it was an urban crime, it was a crime that took place in the city, and the demographics of the city are going to weigh more in favor of African-American jurors or black jurors, they'll ask about whether you're familiar with the crime scene. They'll use that as a basis to get off prospective jurors of African descent or other black jurors. And they'll say they can use that as a for-cause challenge, or at a minimum, it'll provide them a race-neutral reason. And there's sort of these different categories of race-neutral reasons that are sometimes set forth in order to explain why a juror's been challenged.
Have you ever found yourself rolling your eyes going, come on here?
I think I spend most of my time in court rolling my eyes in jury selection and other areas. That's somewhat common. But the problem is that unless the judge is going to go as far as to essentially say, I just don't believe the reason you're setting forth, then that'll be enough to overcome the challenge potentially. And that just doesn't get us far enough along to have any real effect.
Don, go ahead.
Well, I don't think the Batson ruling has necessarily been a failure. It has increased the level of prosecutorial imagination, because you have to come up with some sort of a facially race-neutral reason, and it's sort of your test that you just talked about. The first thing that has to happen in a Batson situation, the prosecutor strikes a juror. The defense attorney then has to say, Judge, I'm making a Batson challenge. I believe that that's a racially motivated strike. The burden then shifts. So first of all, the the defense attorney has the burden of production. They have to stand up and say something. The prosecutor then has the burden of persuasion. They have to say, Judge, it's not a racially motivated challenge because of X. Well, X can be, well, the juror's young, so I don't think they'll participate. They're old, so I don't think they'll participate. They said they would voice their disagreement, so I want jurors that are going to get along. They said they wouldn't voice their disagreement, or they didn't look like they'd voice their disagreement. So then, after the prosecutor sets forth their reasons, the judge has to rule on whether or not, in fact, that is a racially neutral reason. And it's sort of the, oh, come on, test. On appeal, it's an abuse of discretion standard. So, you know, the fact that a juror is young or the fact that a juror is old, is it really a transparent attempt to strike, an African-American juror? I mean, the whole premise behind Batson and the underlying, you know, development that led to this was, and, you know, I have an issue with this, is, you know, because the juror is black, they're going to be more likely to rule for a black defendant. They might be more likely to challenge the authority of a white prosecutor, but they're not going with a black defendant because they're black. And some of the black jurors will take themselves off because they're the worst jurors in a situation like that. They've been exposed in these neighborhoods where they grew up to the kind of violence that maybe is the subject of the prosecution, and you don't want them there because they're going to give you less than a fair shake if that's the circumstance. But there's this kind of lumping everybody in together with just based upon skin tone, which is one of the fallacies, I think, of the whole Batson case development.
No, I think at least from my initial read of it, the idea of Batson was juries ought to look like their communities as largely as possible when possible. If you have a community where 17% of the population is African-American, roughly 15 to 20% of the population of jurors in a given year ought to be African-American instead of three. Yeah, I mean, that's the problem. And yes, it doesn't mean done. I think that's an important point here, that a black juror always goes with a black defendant. Not at all. But if we're not representative, then we do risk probably some abuses. I think that's the concern.
Sure.
Fair?
Yeah, absolutely fair. I think Bill has an interesting idea about the four cause challenges and whether Batson can be implemented at this point.
Well, let's do this because we're going to jump in with what we do to maybe change the system going forward. Because go ahead, Aaron.
I just want to echo very quickly the point that black jurors, despite what prosecutors might want to say or argue, they're not necessarily going to side with the black party in the case. And I've seen this in civil practice. So last year I had the privilege of representing a prisoner, an African-American prisoner, in a civil rights case against several prison guards. And there were black jurors in our jury panel, and none of them wanted to be on the case. And several of them said that they don't like the type of case, they don't want to be involved in it. And we didn't go into detail after that, but I could understand that, they understand the issues and they didn't feel that they can be the most objective given what we were trying to do in that case. So it's certainly real. And I do, just for the benefit of your listeners, Batson does apply in the civil context too, from a case called Edmondson. So even in the civil context where you're suing for money, not trying to put somebody in jail, but where the issue is money, parties have a right to have a jury who's a fair cross-section of the community as well.
Well, for those who are listening going, thinking, does this really happen in court? You really have prosecutors striking possible black jurors and then making sort of fantastical claims or reasons. Think about two things. Think about what we mentioned at the outset here, that in the case of Flowers in Mississippi, the average out of 42 possible black jurors, those black jurors or possible jurors were asked an average of 29 different questions by prosecutors, and the possible white jurors were asked an average of one question. And so the idea is, were they searching for reasons that they could then use to tell a judge, oh, that's why we didn't want this juror, which they aren't doing with white jurors. And yes, there's a piece of video that I thought was shocking, but this is a guy by the name of Jack McMahon, who's a prosecutor in the Philadelphia area. This video is from 1995. So Batson's almost 10 years old at this point, and this is a 1 hour, and I watched almost the whole thing, by the way, so pray for me. But I watched almost an hour talking to a prosecutor training other prosecutors on what to do to try to get the best juries stacked in your favor. It wasn't just about race. One of the points he kept making was you don't want smart jurors. You want people from lower educational backgrounds because they're less likely to think all that critically and deeply about issues. That's interesting. But he was very explicit about race. So let's listen to clip one first. This is him talking specifically about why black jurors can be a problem if there are black defendants and what particular kinds of jurors can be a problem.
Let's face it again. There's the blacks from the low-income areas are less likely to convict. I understand it. It's an understandable proposition. There's a resentment for law enforcement. There's a resentment for authority. And as a result, you don't want those people on your jury. In my experience, black women, young black women, are very bad. There's an antagonism, I guess, maybe because they're downtrodden on two respects. They got two minorities, they're women and they're blacks, and so they're downtrodden on two areas, and they somehow want to take it out on somebody, and you don't want it to be you. Younger black women are difficult.
So what does Jack McMahon, the prosecutor, advise his colleagues to do about that? Here's this explicit advice on how to get around the Batson rule.
In the future, we're going to have to be aware of this case, and the best way to avoid any problems with it is to protect yourself. And my advice would be in that situation is when you do have a black juror, you question them at length, and on this little sheet that you have, mark something down that you can articulate later time if something happens. Because because the way the case is stated, that it's only after a prima facie showing that you're doing this that it becomes that the trial judge can then order you to then start showing why you're striking them not on racial basis. So let's say you strike three blacks to start with, the first three people, and then it's like the defense attorney makes an objection saying that you're striking blacks. Well, you're not going to be able to go back and say, make something up about why he did it. Write it down right then and there. I'd write it right in my little box there, you know, and question him, say, well, the woman had a kid about the same age as the defendant, and I thought she'd be sympathetic to him, or she's unemployed, and I just don't like unemployed people because I find they're not too stable. Any of those reasons, have them marked down in those situations so that if the judge does come to you and say, what about it, McMahon? You could say, judge, this is my reasons, and I have them marked down here. If he puts you into that situation.
Does anybody want to defend this? I mean, I'm not in the legal system. I find that vulgar. Is there a defense for this?
No.
Right, no.
He's teaching prosecutors how to lie effectively to the court. There's no defense for that.
Right.
Okay. Does anybody want to tell me, Evan, be careful because that's more of an outlier, that this kind of advice is not spread widely in prosecutorial quarters? Right on your mic, Bill.
I would argue no. It might be an outlier in the degree of candor the man had.
It's a lot of candor.
Yeah, but I think that type of dialogue is either internalized in offices or in individual prosecutors. I mean, Batson is, you know, puts them to the test to come up with a race-neutral reason. And they're lawyers. And lawyers are pretty inventive. And if you can't come up with at least a superficial race-neutral reason, then you're just not trying. I mean, you can always come up with something, especially if you've been trained to question the African-American jurors at length and ignore the white jurors. And then you're going to have fodder from which to construct very easily what will be a transparently superficial race-neutral reason.
I mean, it's a whole other show on the fact that this guy thinks that unemployed people are unstable. So just point to that. But my goodness, that's just hard for me to listen to. And, I don't mean to be painting all prosecutors in this light. I mean, Mark Foti, are you all that pure that every time you walk into court, you go, I'm not trying to stack this jury in my favor. I just want fairness.
Well, prosecutors and defense attorneys have different responsibilities in the courtroom. So, My job is to be a zealous advocate, and I'm not going to suggest that is always going to overlap with concerns of the fairness of due process to the government. I'm not so much – that's really not on my radar. So I would say I'm in a different position than most prosecutors are. They have a dual function. Yes, they're supposed to be advocates, but primarily and most importantly, they have the function of doing justice in the courtroom, of harboring fairness, which is something that in appellate review, we often see as a basis for seeing cases sent back to the trial courts, because review of their actions are inconsistent with that purpose that is so clearly defined for them. I'll say, you know, on the issue of this effort to overcome Batson, in the Flowers case, this case itself was not an outlier in that office, and there was evidence of that was established in the podcast that gave this some media attention, in the Dark season 2. They did a whole episode of that podcast directed on the issue of jury selection on Batson violations, and they went back and did research on all of the jury selection that was undertaken by this office, and they ultimately determined that throughout all trials, that
not just the Flowers trial,
not just the Flowers,
because Justice Alito, in his joining opinion, seemed to think this was an outlier. The Flowers case was cartoonish, but thank goodness this doesn't happen more often.
Right. I mean, in their research of this office, completely separate from the Flowers trial, I believe that the numbers were prospective black jurors were struck at it was three times or higher than prospective white jurors. So there's this huge disparity there, clearly being demonstrated from case to case to case. And there are district attorney's offices where this is common practice. And I agree with Bill that for some, maybe it's not an office-wide policy that's overtly trained, but it's more of the internalizing that goes on for an individual prosecutor who does not want a juror to be seated, and so they are going to have an argument for legal purposes, but also for their own integrity. None of them are going to come out and say, "Yes, Judge, you know, I didn't because of his race or gender." They're going to have some explanation to protect themselves as well. So it's these strategies are going to be developed one way or another. If whether that's the intent or not, there's going to be some explanation provided that allows prosecutors to consistently overcome Batson in the courtroom.
Aaron Frazier, what do you make of it when you heard Jack McMahon there on tape?
Again, I don't think it's uncommon. I think it was recorded, and that's why we know about it. I think those meetings and trainings happen quite often around the country. It's just probably not recorded in a way that, you know, the public can see how the sausage is made, so to speak. But it is a problem with prosecutorial offices, and I Mark made a good point, because Batson actually does apply to defense as well, but you don't see this problem as often on the defense side. You know, defense attorneys can't discriminate against jurors on the basis of race either. And you know, some people who want to defend the system might try to make this equality argument where, you know, what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Both sides can do it. Both sides have it. But that's not true. That's not a fair argument, because statistically it does not happen on the defense side as much as it happens on the prosecutor's side, even though both of them have peremptory challenges and both of them have this parameter that they have to that they have to stick to. So it's, you know, it doesn't surprise me. The only thing that was surprising was that he spoke so candidly on camera or audio or whatever the recording device was.
He's on camera too.
Yeah.
He wants as many people to see this as possible in his profession.
Yeah.
It's legal. None of what he said is illegal.
Right.
I mean, it's not like this was a scandalous tape that nobody was supposed to see. That's how they do it. So one other point, and then in our second half hour, I do want to ask our guests what we do going forward here, because there's a lot of debate about what needs to happen in courtrooms to make sure the way juries are constructed is fair. You know, Aaron, you briefly spent some time in your career on the prosecutorial side as well. And so you've been on really all sides of this. Help me get sort of the feeling of vulgarity out of my system when I hear this tape, because what I hear is a prosecutor who is in a game to win. I don't hear a person saying, you know, we need to do our job and we need to let the evidence and the juries guide us to the proper conclusions. I hear someone who is out to win at any cost. We don't want smart people. We certainly don't want black people on juries. And here's why, and here's how we get around that. Because the law says we can't do that, but we've got loopholes. That doesn't feel like what the justice system is supposed to feel like. And this is where some people are hearing me go, well, that's Pollyanna, Evan. That's not how it works. And they'll probably also say, prosecutors don't walk into the courthouse thinking that they're wrong anyway. You hope that you're at that point believing that you have a proper case to make. But it felt vulgar to me. It felt like a game to win as opposed to justice to be earned. Help me with that.
Well, I don't think that there's much that I can say to help you with that, Evan. Okay. I mean, that's really, I think, a side effect of having head prosecutors be political. So, I mean, when you bring politics into something, that sort of ramps up the pressure to succeed and get statistics. And then you have various policies around the country that might be counterproductive to this issue, where you have some prosecutors getting bonuses for high conviction rates and things like that. Obviously, that creates a perverse incentive. I don't know that they do that here in Monroe County. So listeners, please don't interpret me as saying that that's I don't know that they do that. And again, when I was at the DA's office, I was there under a practice order. So I only did non-jury trials
because
I was still a law student at the time. So that Batson wasn't even an issue for the cases that I did. I did help felony prosecutors with their jury trials.
And you know what it's like to feel like you want to win a case. No one's out there arguing because you want to lose.
Right, right.
But there's a line that feels like it's been crossed.
Exactly. And there are some unethical prosecutors. You know, there are hate to use, you know, such a cliche, but there are bad apples in every profession. I think you were exactly right to say that many prosecutors who go into court with an honestly held belief that they're in the right, that they're prosecuting somebody who is actually guilty and they want to do the best they can within the rules, however flawed the rules may be, to try to secure that conviction. And then there are some who want to get that bonus if they're in that in such an office. And to the extent that there's a solution to that, try to reduce the amount of perverse incentives that cause such behavior. But it is a very complicated problem.
You want to jump in, Bill?
Yeah, it's an adversarial process, the criminal justice system, for better or for worse. That's the construct we have. And that leads to problems. As Mark says, if it's a purely adversarial process, there can be no more critical stage than jury selection. You win or die with that jury. And prosecutors, as adversaries, are going to try to get the jury that's going to convict, and under intense pressure to do so. And they're going to bend the rules. They're going to work it hard. The problem, as I see it, is you have to put teeth into what Mark is saying, is that prosecutors must function as more than adversaries. They have to have this quasi-judicial function. They have to rise above it and actually try to do justice. And they have to. Their goal should be a jury that reflects a community and do their best with that jury. Not to engage in what we as defense attorneys do routinely, which is try to get the best jury for our cases possible. They are not so unencumbered. And once they fall into that trap that they are just like us and they've got to fight us fair, then we're going to have problems. And Batson's not going to cure those problems.
So as we go to break, just quick yes or no's around the table. Thurgood Marshall said, with the Batson decision, again, he called it historic and that it would ultimately fail. And the recommendation from Justice Marshall was just to eliminate peremptory strikes to begin with. Aaron, yes or no? Eliminate peremptory strikes.
I haven't made up my mind on that, honestly.
Okay, and we can talk about why yes or no after the break. But so you're saying you don't know yet?
I don't know yet.
Bill?
Yes.
Okay, Mark?
No.
Don?
No.
Oh, see? Good. Now we're going to fight after this break here on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wednesday on the next Connections, a new policy implemented by the City of Rochester allows the fire chief to temporarily close firehouses due to low staffing. The move saves the city more than $1 million a year, but a number of residents and some local firefighters are pushing back with concerns about safety. We'll discuss it. In our second hour, presidential candidate Andrew Yang has a proposal to save America's dying malls. Is it worth the effort? We'll talk about it. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our guests are talking about fairness when it comes to juries, in particular, the law that says we can't simply exclude people from juries in this country based on their race. But it still happens. We know it happens. The Supreme Court just said so. Brett Kavanaugh writing the majority opinion in a 7-2 Supreme Court case. Justice Clarence Thomas calling that opinion manifestly incorrect. So the Supreme Court and the conservative justices split. The more progressive justice is not split in that ruling. And listeners, if you want to weigh in on what your expectation is for a jury, have you ever been on a jury? Have you been in that position? Have you been asked questions? How do you feel about fairness and when it comes to representation on juries in this country? It's 844-295-TALK. That's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@wxxi.org. How do you feel about that when you hear prosecutors training each other on how to get around the Batson rule, the rule that says you can't exclude based on race? How you make notes and give judges false reasons for excluding someone, which unfortunately it happens. I'm not alleging that it happens with any routine here in Monroe County. I certainly don't know, but certainly we know that it has happened elsewhere. So, Bill, you're the one on the panel who says get rid of peremptory strikes entirely. Why?
I would subscribe to Justice Marshall's characterization, is that once we go down Batson Road, it's not working to address the underrepresentation of jurors in reflecting the composition of the community. And that is critical. And if Batson's not working there, what we have to do is devise a system that does work. I think such a system should include a system where every jury, every county has a composition. The jury panel should reflect the composition of the county, so that a defendant facing trial is facing a trial by jury of his peers. And so, let's say every trial, and that jury panel should be cause channel. As Mark said, there's cause and peremptory challenges. The attorneys and the judge should question jurors carefully, respectfully, about their abilities to sit as jurors. And we come to a certain percentage of jurors come in there. At that point, that should reflect. If it doesn't reflect the composition of the county, then attorneys are barred, should be barred from exercising peremptories against any jurors until you get the percentage that reflects a community. It's so important to have that community reflection. It's not, as Don was saying, it's not because a minority juror will necessarily side with a minority defendant. It's that a community is composed of various perceptions. And if you arbitrarily rip from the jury panel the perception of a significant component of that community, you're not getting justice. And equally important, you're not getting a perception of justice. You're getting someone like an all-white jury convicts this guy. It's corrosive. It erodes our system, and we need jurors that reflect the community. We're not getting them with Batson. Let's try a different route.
Before I let your colleagues tell you why you're wrong, Don especially, I'm mostly kidding. No, I'm sure he's happy to. I just want to tell the listeners who are on the phone, because all of a sudden we lit the phones up. Please, we're going to get through. If you're on the phone, we're going to try to get through all of you. We just want to get our panelists to kind of weigh in on this very important question. So Bill says eliminate peremptory strikes, essentially. That's why. You say no, Don. Why?
Right. I think Bill has a sort of Pollyanna-ish view of the ability to exercise challenges for cause. I think right now, let's say the cause challenge standard is at a 9. If it were down to a 2 or a 3, and we were able to really eliminate people for cause who were at all questionable, and we go through that whole process, and we have, at that point, a panel that's reflective of the community, take the first 12. What are you going to lose by that? But I don't think we're going to get to that standard, because the same judges who are going to rule on those cause challenges are the judges now who rule on Batson challenges that, well, the juror's too young, so I'm going to buy that as a race-neutral reason. You know, until there's some enforcement of the lowered cause challenge, I think you can't eliminate peremptory challenges because, you know, you made your best cause challenge, the juror didn't get struck, but you know, and the judge knows, and the prosecutor knows, this person probably isn't going to be fair, so there's got to be a mechanism to remove them.
Terrence and Teddy, stay there on the phones right after these comments. Mark, go ahead.
So I'll say this. I think I'm interpreting Bill's comments as essentially saying there are various flaws in the jury selection system, and anybody who's engaged in voir dire would probably agree with that wholeheartedly. And there's this very courageous idea that if we remove the safety net that peremptories provide in some sense, that maybe there'll be efforts to improve the other aspects of the jury selection process, which are so deeply flawed, chief among them being the limitations we're given in terms of time to voir dire, and Bill spoke to that directly. is that, you know, often the attorneys are told, I'm going to strictly limit you to 30 minutes to question this panel of 21 prospective jurors. And in that 30 minutes, somehow we have to learn enough about these prospective jurors to know whether they're qualified and capable of making such a significant decision on cases that could be as serious as murder, where somebody's life is on the line there. And there's these problems of limitations, and I think that perhaps the peremptory challenges give the judges some degree of confidence that there's a guarantee that the attorneys will have some other means to eliminate these jurors, and that is problematic. But with all of that said, you know, it's like getting rid of your seatbelt. Maybe you drive a little bit safer. Maybe there's some efforts to improve driving on the road overall. But all it takes is one lunatic driver to cause real serious damage. And if you have a judge who is incapable of recognizing what an appropriate level, what that appropriate level is that should be applied for cause challenges, mm-hmm. you're going to find jurors seated that have no business being there, and you have no other means to get rid of them.
Yeah, I completely agree. And that's one of the reasons why I'm hesitant about whether we should just do away with peremptories at all, because I definitely recognize it's a problem. It's not serving its purpose. But if we switch to a system that emphasizes cause at the current cause standard, I don't know that we would have any significant improvement. I want to give the listeners a concrete example from the last jury trial I did, the prisoner's rights case. We had a juror seated in that case who was friends with somebody who worked at the prison where the incidents took place. She didn't know any of the guards who were the defendants, and so there was no issue there. But she was friends with somebody who worked at the prison, and that wasn't for cause, because she rehabilitated herself. She said that, despite the friendship, I can be fair and impartial. I know I'm not going to be bullied just because my friend works at the prison. Well, how they would agree or how they would perceive me, depending on my vote in this case, would not bother me or affect me at all. And, the judge accepted that. And then, I couldn't peremptory her because I had to use all my peremptories on other people because they were even worse. So that's an example of, the cause standard not currently being strong enough to be a complete replacement for doing away with peremptory challenges. So if we were to do something with the cost standard, I might be able to wrap my head around the proposed solution a little better. But that's just the issue that I see, and I agree with my colleagues here.
Well, one of our callers has his own experience to share. It's Terrence in Rochester first. Go ahead, Terrence.
Yeah, hey, CC. Now, for me, my experience has been like this. Okay. Three different times when I was called for a jury duty. And for me, it was one of those things where they're asking me questions. I'm looking at them like, it didn't make any logical sense to me what the questions were. Concerning, it just to me, it was like, you're looking for a reason to do something. I mean, I've dealt with law enforcement for years. The type of work I do for a living. I can't really go into what I do for a living. And to me, it was more or less, I looked at when I was sitting people around me in the jury, in the pool, right? And I noticed they come in and out pretty quickly. I'm in there for an extended period of time. I noticed a pattern on three different occasions for jury duty. I noticed the same type of pattern. And it was more or less like, okay. And I noticed, I looked at them, like when I was getting out of there, I looked at a lot of the makeup, and I noticed most of the African-Americans were gone.
So
that's been my experience.
What were they asking you? I mean, what were the kinds of questions that they were asking you that you noticed they weren't asking white possible jurors?
Yeah. I mean, for the first thing, the guy asked me, he goes, have you ever been, do you know a drug dealer? And I'm like, what? Literally, that was the question. Do you know any drug dealers? I'm looking at him like, okay. I'm saying, I don't really know because I don't deal with any drug dealers. So I may know somebody. I might know somebody who maybe doing this. I don't get in their personal life. It's not my business. But it was more or less like, what? Mm. I mean, for my thing is this. I've worked in years. Let's say I worked in the intelligence field for a number of years. Okay? I'll leave it at that. And for me, so asking that kind of a question, I'm like, you look like he's fishing for something. I mean, I've been profiling people for years, a much higher level. And to me, it always seemed they were searching for a profile to a feature to remove me for something. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty good at what I was trained to do. So I'm like, yeah, that's, and it just seemed a pattern on three different occasions.
Did you ever end up on a jury, Terrence?
No.
No.
I was looking for all three.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you sharing the experience. I mean, it really illustrates exactly what we're talking about, and I'm sorry to hear that. But thank you, Terrence.
You're welcome.
Evan,
go ahead, Bill.
I think Terrence's call illustrates a further problem with Batson. Kavanaugh gets into the disparate amount of time that certain prosecutors spend questioning African-American jurors to get the ammunition to remove them, and talks about, you know, the effect that has on the criminal justice system, but it has a fallout as well in the community. Terrence comes back from it. He understands he's been subjected to unfair treatment. He has a bitter experience with the juror system. That translates and ripples out. And that happens, you know, weekly in our system.
Excellent point. Yep.
Yeah, and just, you know, if you read Brett Kavanaugh's decision, he has talked and written about Batson in the past. I don't know. I didn't watch all of his testimony before Congress before he was confirmed. I don't know if anybody would ask him about this. And this is something that I think would be fascinating to know from his perspective, because he clearly thinks that this is an important law. He's cited it as one of the best decisions that the court has ever made. This 1980s rule, he seems to think, has cured a problem. So even if you want to credit him for this ruling, depending on what your mindset is, it'd be very interesting to know if he thinks that Batson is effective. And I don't think you would cite this as one of the great Supreme Court decisions if you don't think it's been an effective one. So clearly our guests in studio, even if they agree or disagree on peremptory strikes, doesn't necessarily think it's been effective. Teddy in Rochester next on the phone. Go ahead, Teddy.
Hi. I didn't catch any of this regarding the Supreme Court decision with Brett Kavanaugh. I will just say this. Considering the strangeness of the way that he was brought on as a Supreme Court justice, and I would imagine some of you in the panel are thinking, wow, that was really weird, and how was he still confirmed? I beg the question, does anyone know of a system for holding accountable lawyers to certain principles? Like, you know, not just screening the jurors, you know, but screening the lawyers, especially if you are, you know, a DA, to municipal, you know, apparatus for quality assurance for the character of the lawyers involved. And I actually want to hear, I'll stay on to hear what the answer to that is and
right,
maybe respond.
All right, Teddy, thank you. Some thoughts on that?
So I'm not sure if this is a current statistic, but I think a couple of years ago, John Oliver, the comedian, did a show on this subject. And one of the studies he cited was some organization did a look at some 600 cases where appellate judges had confirmed issues of prosecutorial misconduct. And out of those, only one other prosecutor had actually faced disciplinary charges. So there are committees that are supposed to police lawyers. But based on that one out of 600 statistic, it doesn't seem like it's easy to bring disciplinary charges against a prosecutor who has been found by an appellate court.
And I think I know what he's saying. But, Don, I mean, I don't know how we're going to necessarily police or throw up. I mean, one way is elections, and the district attorney gets elected. But what do you think of what you heard there from Teddy?
Well, yeah, there's a whole body of law that's developed in the area of prosecutorial misconduct. You know, appellate courts are willing to, you know, say that there's been prosecutorial misconduct, but it's sort of like the walrus, you know, crying the tears as he eats the oysters. You know, if they're not going to actually do anything about it, how effective is it? You know, it's recognized, but what's the sanction? There's very infrequently any sanction, even where prosecutorial misconduct is recognized. And, you know, in the Batson area, the sanction is normally reversal of the conviction. But nothing, you know, personally against the prosecutor, even Mr. Evans here, who, you know, tried six different cases, striking 41 out of 42 African-American jurors. There's no personal sanction with respect to him as a result of those actions, although I think everybody at this point acknowledges that it was improper.
Yeah, in fact, Justice Thomas in his dissent celebrated the fact that we could see a seventh Flowers trial and expects that we will. So as we get ready to wrap in our last minute, just briefly, listeners, you really ought to check out the 2016 podcast. The podcast is called More Perfect, and the episode is called Object Anyway. And it's the story of the Batson rule, but also whether it's working or not. And the reporter who put together that podcast is allowed to make a conclusion at the end. And his conclusion, I will say, is blunt and is not optimistic on whether we're going to solve this issue of discrimination and jury pools. And I'll just ask you briefly, are you optimistic that we're going to find a better way?
I don't see how.
Mark?
Not currently, no.
Okay, Bill?
Bitterly pessimistic.
Aaron?
I'm not optimistic either.
Does everyone feel good? You ready to run through a wall this afternoon? Look, I don't mean to be flippant, but that's a harsh indictment of the current system. Even with the rule in the mid-80s that it was meant to solve this problem, that's tough. But I do want to thank our guests for being here and tangling with where we go next with it. Our thanks to Aaron Frazier, an attorney with Harris Beach. Aaron, always good. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Two partners joining us from Easton, Thompson, Kasparek, and Schifrin. And that's Don Thompson. Thank you, Don.
Thank you, Evan.
And Bill Easton. Thank you, Bill.
Pleasure, Aaron.
Yeah, that's okay. It's Evan. Aaron's right next to you. It's okay.
Pleasure too,
Aaron. It's a pleasure to Aaron, too. And it's a reluctant pleasure to Mark Foti, principal attorney with the Foti Law Firm. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Evan.
David Griffin is the volunteer today. Rob Braden is the engineer who does such great work. Every time the host clicks a pen or makes a mistake or drops something, the listeners can never see Rob's face, but he's so lenient and patient with me. And he's the best in the business. And Megan Mack, you know, is the most outstanding producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.